Thank you. Welcome to Dean's Corner. It's almost warm. This is really good. I can still tell you that I still think I have the best job on campus. So I really am having quite a good time, although I have to admit that when I go home, I'm very tired. So I sleep well at night. The jury is still out for me in terms of Four Seasons, because I have yet to believe that they really exist. And it will be really nice when it's truly warm. We will get there. I have faith. We have a long agenda today, and unless we begin very quickly, we won't get through it. I do want to remind you that individual speakers will, most of them will probably entertain questions at the end of their talks. And those who are coming in remotely can send questions to Bruna. Right, there's a sign-in, and she will relay the questions, and we will repeat them, and we will repeat them. That's information to everybody who's speaking for on behalf of everybody who's streaming in, and we'll answer those questions to the best of our ability. So I'd like to introduce first Wayne Wood, who's Associate Director of Environmental Health and Safety, and he's going to talk to us about some of the real issues before us during with our renovations. So.
Great. Thank you, Dean Cook. I would like to assure you that we indeed have four seasons, and they are as follows. There's winter, there's early winter, there's late winter, and there's next winter. Okay. This is a week where we can joke about temperature and high temperature as something that we only fantasize about, but I can assure you it is coming. We will be getting some very warm temperatures, and I understand that with the work to be done in your building in combination with some changes to the air conditioning system, that it might in fact affect you. So what I'm here to do is to talk to you about dealing with high temperatures. They are coming. And I'm going to approach it more from a pedagogical point of view to explain what the issues are and to give you an understanding of what the limits are, what are the things that affect how hot we get, and what are the things that we can do to make ourselves more safe and more comfortable. As for contingency plans, what's going to be done when the conditions do arrive, what are the plans for dealing with you and your work situations and keeping the library up and running? That I will leave in the hands of your management team to go over. So I'm going to speak more about the...
Just click through? Yeah, your presentation's in our presentation.
It's not advancing? I'll try the space bar, but I do need to use the pointer at some point. I need a functional mouse because part of what I'm going to be doing is... But I don't have the mouse pointing. It's not functioning. I do. Stuart has left. Okay, I'll manage. I'll do without. Good. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good old reboot. Okay. So what I want to first speak about is how much is too much? What is considered conditions where the temperature is too high or that the heat is too unbearable in terms of your comfort, in terms of efficiency, and in terms of your health? Then I want to point out to you what the regulations say about dealing with heat, and I'll explain to you that the regulations weren't actually designed for library situations, and you'll see that what's presented is not necessarily that workable or understandable. And then I'm going to present to you what we call the Humidex system, which I think many of you are familiar with. It's often used in weather forecasting and is a very good indicator of the actual heat that you're experiencing. And then I want to go over the McGill guidelines and the strategy that's been developed to deal with this, because believe it or not, you won't be the first building at McGill to have to deal without air conditioning for a period of time during a heat wave. It's something that does occur. Given the age of our buildings, breakdowns do occur, and there are sometimes unexpected heat waves when the buildings aren't set up for it. So we do have experience with this. So I want to go over the various factors that determine how hot you are, how hot you feel, what is the effect on your body, okay? And these are the various factors. And the first one, of course, that comes to mind is temperature. It's the most common indicator of heat, but it is a measure of heat, but it's not the measure of heat. It's an indicator of heat. Heat that you absorb in your body is a combination of the heat, the temperature of the air that's in contact with your skin as your body tries to reach an equilibrium with its surrounding, as well as you can absorb radiant heat, like heat from the sun. It doesn't warm the air so much as it warms the object that it's striking. So if you're familiar with radiant heaters that are in some homes, they're designed not so much to heat the air but to heat the person in the room. So if you have a thermometer and you measure the temperature out in the sun, you're going to get a different reading than if you put the thermometer out in the shade. Because in the shade, it's not absorbing radiant heat. It's just an indicator of the temperature of the air. Okay? So that's an important factor to remember. I would also ask, though, if you put those thermometers outside to measure the temperature, and you took one of them and you wrapped a wet gauze around it, will you get the same temperature? You're going to get a lower temperature, exactly. So we're going to talk about that now when we get into the issue of humidity. The level of humidity in the air is a very, very important factor, not only in the winter when we're trying to avoid dry air, which is not very comfortable, but in the summer when we're dealing with humid air. Our bodies cool by way of sweating, okay, by way of perspiration. It's the evaporation of the water from our skin that creates a cooling effect. That's why it's possible for us, our body temperature is 36.6 degrees, to still be able to regulate the temperature, even if the air temperature is 40 degrees. It's possible for you to still stay at regular body temperature and manage your heat if the air is dry enough. Okay? It requires the air be dry enough for the water to evaporate from your skin to get that cooling effect. That cooling effect becomes diminished the more humid it is. And it's a good time to talk about humidity. When I left my office earlier, it was about 45% relative humidity, and we're experiencing one of those Montreal humidity shifts where it's jumped up over 20% in just about an hour. You feel it, don't you? And that's because the air has more water in it. We're not sweating. Our sweat is not evaporating as efficiently. It's lingering on our skin. We all feel a little clammy, and we're not getting that cooling effect, okay? So one way to control heat is by dehumidification. Well, guess what? When you're air conditioning, it also tends to lower not only the temperature but the humidity in the air. So the expression, it's not the heat, it's the humidity, is really, really relevant here. I've always wondered, I took a closed room and you put a humidifier and a dehumidifier in the same room and made them fight it out, who would win? Actually, I don't know the answer, but I know how I would figure it out. After a period of time, I would go in and see which tank was more than half full. Then we'd declare the winner. Then there's air movement. Okay? Air movement tends to speed evaporation. Okay? So if you've got some air movement across your skin, it tends to assist the evaporation and cool you faster. Okay, so a fan will provide great relief when it's hot. When you start to approach 100% humidity and you're not sweating anymore, it starts not to make a big difference. Okay, if you've ever been out when it's really, really humid and the wind's blowing at you, it's not cooling you. Okay, it's not cooling you very much. So if you have a fan in a room and you close that room and leave the room, what happens to the temperature in the room? Will it continue to cool the room? Will the temperature stay the same? Actually, the temperature will go up. Okay? The fan generates heat. The motor generates heat. We'll add to the heat of the room. Okay? So if you've got a fan running in a room, there's nobody in the room, you're not cooling the room. Okay? So if you leave a room, if you're not in there, if you can turn off your fan, turn off your lights, anything that generates heat, it will give you some relief. And that's a take-home tip, too. This works not only at work, but at home when you're dealing with the heat. Then there's the question of how hard you're working. When we get to the regulations, you'll see that the government regulations on dealing with heat were based mostly on workers who are actually working outdoors doing very, very strenuous labor where there is a serious risk of heat stress. And they take into very much account how hard you're working, so what type of work that you're doing. And again, it wasn't necessarily conceived for library work, where only some of the work is actually manual labor. So if you're doing work like shelving, yes, that's manual work. You're moving around, you're moving your body, you're moving things. That adds to your heat load. And if you're getting too hot, it does make sense to take a work break. And there will be more discussion about that around the contingency plans. That's a reasonable strategy to take. But if you're doing work where you're not really generating that much heat anyway, let's say you're typing, slowing down on the typing is not going to make a difference. It's taking rest breaks if you're already doing sedentary type work is not going to necessarily help you cool down. So reducing your work rate, taking breaks, applies if you're working at a rate that you're generating a significant amount of heat. Then there's the clothing strategies. Okay? In the desert, you see people are often fully covered. How does that work? How does it work? Yeah, it's protecting them from the radiant heat of the sun. And also, most of the clothing they wear is quite loose. There's some breathability. And the air is very, very dry in the desert. So they do benefit from the evaporative heat. And you'll see that the desert clothing, they're not sopping wet. So in that environment, actually, it kind of works. But I don't think that works well in the indoor, particularly library environment. Then there's the approach of wearing less. So that you have enough skin surface exposed so that you can sweat properly. I'm not sure that approach will be warmly received in the library either. And then these days you'll see there's a wide range now of clothing that is designed to perform better. For those of you who do sports, like myself, I do a lot of bicycling. We've discovered all these wonderful microfiber fabrics that are breathable, that allow sweat to leave your skin and pass through your clothing and not get wet. So the choice of clothing that you wear, the degree of breathability have an impact. So I highly recommend that you wear clothing that's breathable. It has a loose weave or is rated for its breathability that will really help you a lot. Then, of course, there's water intake. We've been talking about water when we discussed humidity and sweating and all of that. So if you don't have enough water, it's going to affect your ability to generate sweat, your ability to cool. Because you're sweating a lot in a heat situation, you might be shedding more water than you normally shed. And you could be depleting your body's water supply, which can then affect electrolyte balance and all sorts of things, which then trigger the cramps and the unpleasant situations that lead to more traditional heat stress. It's our intent not to let anybody here get anywhere close to heat stress conditions. We're not going to be lining up the stretchers. We're in fact going to be making sure that well before those types of conditions arise that people will be well taken care of. So make sure that you're consuming adequate amounts of liquids. And if it's warmer than usual, well, you can step up your liquid consumption more than usual. Then is the individual factors. We know from experience that what might be comfortable to one person is uncomfortable to the next person. That's why standards for comfort temperature in buildings generated by the standards councils usually generate a range of temperatures in which they usually say 80% of the population will be comfortable. In other words, there is no ideal temperature or condition that is perfect for everyone, and there's some variability in preferences. But beyond that, there's also some variability in health status when you're getting into higher temperatures. You always hear in the news that if there's an extreme heat wave, who are the first to be affected? The elderly, those who have compromised cardiovascular systems, they're maybe not as able to deal with that. Well, we have in our own midst lots of people dealing with all kinds of medical conditions and situations that might make them more sensitive to heat than for others. So it's really important to be open to that and flexible to that. If somebody is really uncomfortable because of the heat, I would tend to believe them. So what do the regulations say? I people say. The first thing, the regulations say that if you want to evaluate heat stress, the first thing you need is 3 thermometers. You need one with a wet bulb on it, which would reflect the evaporation rates. You would need one with a globe on it, a black globe, which tends to represent the absorption of radiant heat, let's say from sunlight. And then you would need a regular dry thermometer to just measure what the regular air temperature is. And then you take that and you have to pump it into a formula, the WBGT, or we call it Wigbit. And there you take a portion of each of the readings you get from the thermometer and you compute what's called the WBGT. And then that takes you to a graph. Maybe I should use my pointer here. Not showing. Well, it takes you to this graph which shows 4 different readings of the WBGT, how much rest break you should take. Okay, so it's not saying this is a limit you should not exceed, this is what the government says is too high a heat level. It's simply saying if you're at these heat levels, this is how much a rest break you should take. That's not really a satisfactory guideline for our situation because, again, we're not dealing with intense manual labor, and the solution to dealing with the heat is not necessarily to slow down or take breaks, especially if your work is not demanding anyway. So basically, the government regulations are really aimed at workers doing intensive manual labor and generally outdoors in the sunlight where they're also being subject to the radiant heat. These are the workers who the government sees as truly at risk of heat stress, and the regulations were developed for them, and not so much for us. So let me take you to, and as I say, it's not suited well for the office environment either. So let me take you to the Humidex scale, which is a lot more understandable and provides a much more practical guideline on the decisions we need to make around how hot is too hot. So the Humidex scale takes into account not only the temperature and also the humidity and generates a number called Humidex, and then we can base our decisions or base our evaluations on that. So let me do an example for you. I brought my monitor with me. Right now it's 24.2 degrees Celsius. It was under 23 when we arrived, but with the full room and heating up outside, the temperature is going up a little bit. So we'll say it's 24 degrees. My pointer is the wrong color. Let me fix this. I can't get it going. Well, I'm sorry. My pointer is white on a white background. So my temperature is 24 degrees. My humidity level now, oh my gosh, guess what the humidity is now? When I left my office, it was 45. When I came in this room, it was 60, went up to 65 by the time I started speaking. Where do you think we are now? 71. So it's still going up, okay? So, well, we've gone from, is my pointer working now? Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much. So we had 24 degrees, and we started at 45% humidity. So if I go on the scale here, on the Humidex scale, we're talking 26 degrees, and according to the color chart here, there should be no discomfort at that level, okay, at that temperature. But then the humidity started to go up. So at the beginning of the class, it was just beforehand, it was 60% humidity, and that took us up to 28 on the Humidex scale. We're still in the comfort level. We're okay. But now, look, we've gone up to 70% humidity, and that's 30 on the Humidex scale, and we're getting into the point where there is some discomfort. How many of you are feeling some discomfort now based on the current conditions? Very? Great. I would say, well, according to the chart, you might be feeling some discomfort at this level. So that's basically how the scale works. And the way it's designed, and you'll see the various ranges at the bottom. So when you hit 30, you start to feel some discomfort. And some people are going to feel some discomfort, not everybody. Some might be cool with this. When you get into the next zone, you see into the yellow zone, you're starting to get into great discomfort. Avoid exertion. Which means if you're at 40 on the humidex or higher, and you're also doing work that's going to raise your heat level, you're going to be quite uncomfortable. Okay, so that's the point at which you really have to think seriously about alternate arrangements or doing other things. Because even though, according to the chart, you're not getting into the range where it's necessarily dangerous for the health of a healthy person, it's pretty hard to work. It's getting at the point where it's really hard to concentrate and doesn't make a lot of sense to be paying people to sit at a desk when they're not productive anymore. So that's why I say we're not interested in taking this to levels where people are actually being exposed to heat stress and the risk of heat stress, because well before you get into that point, you've lost productivity. Okay. So what are our McGill guidelines? Our McGill guidelines are based on the Humidex scale. Both the people at managed facilities and the projects, as well as the management team here, are aware of the Humidex scale and the fact that when we move into the different levels, it will affect our actions and what we do. It's also based on making the best use of available resources. There are many ways that you can maintain conditions of a workplace without full dependency on air conditioning systems. In fact, we have a lot of buildings still at McGill that don't have AC systems, and I can assure you that they make best use of every measure they can to try to keep their workspaces comfortable. This applies at home as well. Many people might not have air conditioning at home, but try to deal with the heat. And so these are some of the things that you can take advantage of, such as opening the windows, if you have openable windows, and, of course, opening them at the time when it's cool. Okay, opening windows at night will give you some relief. In the daytime when you're home or your surroundings are cooler than outside, it might have the opposite effect. It's important to draw blinds whenever there is sunlight exposure. So if you have an office or space on the east side, well, you want to close the blinds in the morning, and if it's on the west side, to close them in the afternoon. Fans will be made available, will be a great help to keep the workspace comfortable. Very important to reduce heat sources. Turn off those lights, turn off things that aren't being used, turn off your computers. Unplug adapters and these things that are just sitting there plugged in that aren't being used. They're all generating heat. They're adding to the heat load. Ventilate overnight where possible. And one of the measures that the project team does have control over is the air and the airflow. And when we get a good amount of cooling at night, they can take advantage of that to cool the air inside, as well as cool the contents of the building. Because as things heat up and get warm, objects radiate. The building, after a while, starts to radiate. So by cooling it at night, it helps keep it comfortable. Excuse me. We also talked about rest breaks, the importance of rest breaks, particularly if you're doing manual work. The choice of clothing. I presume there'll be a tolerance to casual, summerly-like clothing during this period. Having water, supplemental water, will be assured. And where possible, dehumidification. It's not always feasible if you've got a large HVAC system, but in some of the smaller spaces, it might be possible. And then there's relocation, where an area becomes unbearable, and that's where I'll let the management team talk about where those spaces are and what will be made available to you and what arrangements can be made. So I should finish off, though, with there is a famous quote from Harry S. Truman, who apparently said, if you can't take the heat, then get out of the kitchen. But as apparently Harry didn't really spend much time in the kitchen. So he might have meant something else. Apparently he spent a lot more time in the Library of Congress than in the kitchen. So maybe what he really meant to say was, if you can't take the heat, get out of the library.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any questions? From near or far? Yes.
If we're working in an area with a high ceiling, for example, a ton of lobby, would it help if we had
Well, your ventilation system is going to... I'm sorry.
Repeat the question.
Okay, the question is, in the McLennan lobby, would it... Yes, with our high ceilings, would it be useful to install dehumidifiers? As far as I understand, the ventilation system is going to continue to operate. There will be air circulated in the building.
There are giant heat right now in Redcliffe.
Yes. Just to finish the... But what I'm trying to say is the air will be circulated, okay, so although there might not be air conditioning or cooling, if you place dehumidifiers to try to dry the air, that dried air is taken away so quickly by the big building air conditioning system, it won't make a dent, no. It would work at home in your bedroom or in a basement or in a closed area where you have a low ventilation rate, but that's the problem with dehumidifiers, air ionizers, purifiers, anything of the portable variety, they're of little use in a large building where the air exchange rates overwhelm what those little things were designed to do. I hope that answers your question. Yes?
The unloadings are still cool, and this morning I inquired, would it be possible to prop open the entrance doors to the building? Would that help?
It could. I wasn't at the meeting when the measures to cool the building were discussed with the project people.
They discussed
that one.
That will be done.
Yes, there's that, and there's the possibility of cranking up the ventilation system at 4 in the morning when the temperature hits the lowest rate. So they're going to try to make use of every available means to keep the building cool. What's good about the situation, and I don't get to deal with this often, is we're planning for this. Most of the air conditioning problems we run into were totally unplanned. Yes? Good suggestion.
We will take it under advisement.
It's a good answer, too.
Yes. Yes, and it would be great if that sort of culture could continue thereafter, because our sustainability office would be happy to, for us to send out that message, too. I totally agree. Maybe we could reinforce that, get everybody to participate in reducing the number of machines that are left on and reducing, they call it plug load. Just the equipment that's just left plugged in and it doesn't need to be plugged in many cases is generating heat, drawing electricity. That's right. All of these heat sources add up to the total heat load of the building. It makes a difference. Good point. Thank you. Okay. Right. Thank
you
very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So the microphone gets turned over to Amber, who is going to do a renovation update, a general renovation update. I just want to remind everybody that the only renovations in our library family are not happening in Hustle and Redpath, that we do have ongoing renovations going on actually in music, law, and planning in life sciences. So there are many of us who are having to deal with these issues. So I'm going to turn it over to Amber, who's going to be talking primarily about Hustle, but we do plan and we'll keep you up generally with renovations in all of our libraries.
Okay, facilities and construction updates. Let's start with the good news, which is that the phase one of the project is nearly complete, which was the cleaning and replacement of the ductwork. And so Redpath Building, except for an internal staff corridor where some of you are located, that's completed, and the McLennan Building is completed. And we'd really like to thank everybody for their patience during that project. It went relatively smoothly, but we're very happy to report that's completed. But what I'm probably mainly here to talk about today is Phase 2, which is what our first presentation was related to as well. And that is what you are all aware of, which is that on May the 16th, the Redpath mechanical room equipment was shut down, and it's being replaced. And now the McLennan equipment is being used to cool both buildings. And for those of us that work in that complex, we know that right now there's a major temperature difference between the two buildings. And you can pick us out because you can tell that I work in the cold building and that some people up there are working in the hot building. There's about a 10-degree difference right now. And one of the things that I can tell you about that's not on this slide, and forgive me because I'm not an HVAC expert, but Francisco tried to explain this to me, is that when they did that shutdown on May 16th, they discovered that there were some coils that had been damaged over the winter, and they're actually working on replacing those right now. And so they have let us know that we can expect a bit of an improvement in the situation over the next week as they do that. So for those of you that are thinking, oh my goodness, it's going to, you know, it's for sure going to be like this, we're hoping for a bit of improvement next week, and I hope I explained that properly. So I can pass that along. And then the next phase of the project, just to remind you, is that when that replacement is done, then we'll reverse the situation. And those of us in the cold building will probably be feeling the heat. And by then it'll be hotter as well. So we'll maybe switch wardrobes. Who knows? So what are we doing to deal with this situation? We had our presentation earlier to give you some very good information about how to deal with the temperature, but of course we're also doing some things locally to address the conditions, and that's what I'm going to go through. And some of it might be a slight repeat of what we just heard. I'm going to try not to repeat too much, but there are reasons for repeating it. So our strategies for dealing with it are alternate workspaces, and we actually have two of those. So I think in our memo we talked about one alternate workspace, but we very quickly put together an additional alternate workspace, and that one is actually in the building. And it's in the Humanities and Social Sciences Library, third floor, room 337A. And we worked with ICS, and learned that people can do this thing called remoting into their desktop. We'll teach you all about it if you need to learn about it. And by doing that, you have access to what you have on your computer right now. And if you need help moving materials or other equipment, you just have to work with us, and we'll help you do that. So it's going to be really easy, and all you have to do is ask. That's all you have to do. If you're uncomfortable, you just ask, and we'll help you do this, and all are welcome in this space. So I hope you'll take us up on it. We also have another alternate workspace, because you may just want to get right out of the building because of the temperature, or maybe later on you're going to have concerns about the asbestos. So there's one that's outside the building. But it's the same situation for that workspace. You're going to be able to have access to the same programs you have at your desk right now, and we'll help you move things if necessary. And all you have to do is ask, and all are welcome in that space as well. For some of our staff, though, it's going to be hard to move their work. They work on a public service desk, or they do shelving, and obviously we can't move that over shoe, like that wouldn't work. So for those areas, we have some strategies as well. So those areas are going to be carefully monitored, first of all, and we're going to start sharing that information. But we want to let you know that if you're uncomfortable, you're going to be taking more frequent breaks. You're going to talk to your supervisor and arrange to take more frequent breaks. We've also got a cool zone set up, which I've got a little bit more information on upcoming. We've got fans, and we're going to do some of these other things that we talked about already, keeping doors open, dimming lights, lowering shades, encourage you to dress lightly, more comfortably. And that super cooling thing that we just heard about, where they build up the cool air during the cooler hours of the day and then release it to cool down the building. That's going to be done as well. So where is that cool zone? I think I've got a picture coming up soon. It's on the fourth floor. We've got chairs set up there already. There's going to be some water in there. There may soon be a cooler with some popsicles in there, we hope. We're taking notes. And that's where you can go for your rest break to cool yourself down. Oh, here it is. So this is our cool zone.
And why is it a cool zone?
Oh, that's a good question, Diane. Because the fourth floor is on a separate ventilation system that was set up for rare books and special collections. You guys know that that's a cool area in our building. And so that's why this particular area was designated as our cool zone. So I think you've heard about fans. I get lots of emails about fans. We had a fan club going this week where they were putting together the fans. So I think everyone knows now, but we'll repeat it again. If you need a fan, you just get in touch with us. And something else that we're also working on is water. So these are the locations that we're going to be placing some water. All we ask is that you bring your own mug, but you'll have access to that water because we know that that's important during this time. We are going to be monitoring and starting to share that on our renovation website. So you can look forward to that information coming soon. And what we really want to make very clear is that if you're uncomfortable, we can find an alternate location or help you with all of these other strategies as well. So this was already covered, so I can probably go pretty quickly through this, but I know a lot of you have sent this to me, so I wanted to acknowledge it as well. We know what those regulations say, although I'm not sure I still understand it even after that very good explanation. But what we're really trying to tell you is that no matter what that says, if you're uncomfortable, we'll work with you. You just have to let us know. So that's really the main point about that. Of course, our students and faculty and visitors to our library are going to be asking about this as well. And we've got some signs that will be in place and screens and all those sorts of things that I've talked about in other presentations. But really the message, if you're wondering what you should be saying, is that the collection is accessible, but we really do recommend that they make use of one of our other more cooler libraries during this period. And it could be that they are not familiar with those, so it would be great if we could, you know, tell them about some of our other cooler libraries, because maybe they just use our library and don't know about them so much. So we'll have some materials to help you with that as well. I also wanted to update you on the work that we've been doing in our working groups. So we've told you about our working groups, and we have been meeting on a weekly basis, and I think making some really excellent progress. We formed the groups to get feedback, and we're getting a lot of feedback from those groups. They're working really hard and thinking really carefully and doing really good work. And some of the discussions in that group have been around where and how to set up our single service point when we get to the July phase, when we need to shut down areas because of the asbestos abatement. And so some of the things that we've come to are that we're going to have a new e-classroom installed in the former EDRS space sometime in mid-August, which is going to allow us to put the reserve collection in the former e-classroom. We've been working on a design of a service desk, looking at the best place for a consultation zone, and figuring out how best to make sure that we maintain our service delivery during all of this. We've been looking at new seating arrangements, and we've come up with a way to get input from the staff on where in that arrangement they'll be sitting. So all of that information is being very worked on very carefully right now, and more information will be coming to you soon about all of those things. The terrace upgrade is still coming along. That project will begin in June, and this is an FAQ on our website, but just to repeat it again, if you're a staff person that has mobility issues and is worried about that, you just have to get in touch with us to work through that issue. So, just so we don't forget, the renovation website is going to have the late breaking news on all of this as we go along, and that if you have any feedback or concerns as we go through the project, any member of the renovation team will work with you and your supervisor to address them. And I can take questions now or at the end. Oh, you know what? I did forget something. I got a late breaking news that I totally forgot to pass along. So Francisco handed this to me just as I was coming up. They're going to change the settings on the public PCs to go to sleep faster than they do right now. So that was there was a suggestion just as I was coming up. And of course, we'll have other strategies like that. As you guys come up with these ideas, we'll work on them and try to implement them as quickly as we can.
While we have a change of microphones here, I want to thank Amber and everybody on the working groups for all of the hard work involved in planning for the renovations, but also just the general goodwill of everyone. This could be a lot more unpleasant than it has been or being. And if everybody weren't willing to look at this in a positive way, it would be a lot harder, and I very much appreciate that. Ed's going to be talking about two things, and I'm not going to introduce his second topic. He's just going to entertain questions for the first and then go straight on to the second.
I will stop for applause.
Okay. Okay, that's good. We'll make sure that we do that. Clueless. Okay. There we go. Travel guidelines.
Okay. So more specifically, I'm here on behalf of the Personnel Development Committee to talk just a little bit and give you just a very quick overview about some of the funding that's available to you for personnel development. This committee is chaired by Louise Robertson, and I'm on it, Anne-Marie Holland, as well as April Colissimo. We make up the committee together, when you'll hear me make reference to it a few times in the presentation. So very quickly, there are three sources of funding when you're looking into travel and development. The first is individual funding for librarians, and that's a $1,500 fund that each librarian has to use at their discretion in order to attend conferences and the like. There's also funding available for administrative travel and development, which I won't talk too much about here, but this is when it's required for administrative reasons. There is funding available to make sure people can do and fulfill those responsibilities. What I'm here to talk to you about primarily is the personnel development. Now, this is open to all library employees. It's not restricted simply to librarians. It's open to all employees. And it is a fund that's been allocated specifically for training and development. So workshops, seminars, webinars, anything that's there to develop skills and your abilities, their fund is in place to make that happen. This includes also travel and accommodations. If you need to travel somewhere for a workshop, stay overnight for a workshop, this is also something that can be covered under this fund as well. The Personnel Development Fund can also be used in conjunction with other funding sources. So let's say you're attending a conference, and at the conference you would cover that using different funds, but let's say there's a workshop before the conference, a pre-conference workshop, you can have money's available from this fund to cover that cost, the cost of the workshop, the cost of the extra night stay in the hotel, as well as any extra meal and accommodations that you have to incur because you attend this workshop. So you can use it in conjunction with other sources as well. This is you can see the form here, which has undergone several rapid iterations since we first launched it, based on experience, and that's been very instructive for us. All the forms and guidelines are available at that extremely long address there. I'll make all this information available on the staff blog as soon as I get back to my desk, so you'll be able to get all the information there. But the form, as well as all the policies and guidelines around this, are all available on the U Drive at that location. So that's just quickly what I wanted to overview. I'm just going to step through the form here, because although it is an extremely good form and very well designed and very well thought out and tested, I still think it needs maybe just a bit of an overview. So, and the whole purpose, reason I want to go over it is because we want to make sure that your requests are expedited as soon as possible. So the clearer it is and the easier you, the more you understand how to use the form, the better the information we'll have, and we'll be able to make a decision right on the spot, as opposed to having to go back to you and ask for more information because we're not clear about certain things. So the top half of the form, fairly straightforward, identifying information about yourself as well as for the conference, workshop, or whatever training event that you will be attending. And just a quick note here, which I was asked to remind you about, the other thing we're also interested in is not just training opportunities where you go somewhere else, but training opportunities where we bring someone onto campus, when we bring someone to the library so that multiple people can take part without having to send everybody somewhere else. And that's something that the committee will look at. If there are some training opportunities that someone identifies, we may come back and propose that we have this held in the library if we identify that there is an audience for it. And that's sort of part of the back and forth that we'll do with when these requests come through. Taking time to articulate organizational benefits as well as personal benefits. This is important for us when we're making a decision. It's important for us to understand what the event is about, what kind of things you'll be learning, and why this is relevant to both to your own personal and professional development as well as to the organization. Okay, and you can fill out information here. You can attach information. You can, if they have descriptions, outlines, overviews of what it's about, the more information you provide, not 700 pages, but if you provide additional details on it, it makes our job a lot easier, okay, because sometimes we have very scant details and we can't make a decision, and that will just delay the process, okay? So please try to provide the information to us so that we can make an informed decision about that, okay? Now, in the second lower half of the form, things start to get a bit crazier. So we have a few areas to look at. The first thing here is that there is a place for you to indicate if you are simply filling out the form to get the approval to go, but you don't actually need any funding. You're not making a request for specific funding. Maybe you're funding it personally because you've already used your other funding. Maybe you have a different source of funding for this, but you nevertheless still have to complete the form. That tick box helps us to know that you really did mean to submit this without any funding request. And it helps eliminate any confusions that there might be. Okay? Then the next part we get to is where you complete, for the event, the amounts that you're requesting under the appropriate funds. Now, in most cases, you are going to just be filling out things under one column. But it is possible, for example, in the case of a librarian going to a conference where there is a workshop beforehand, you may fill out, you may claim the amount for the conference under the individual column and fill out those rows. But the cost associated with the pre-conference workshop, you would fill out under personnel development. Okay, so there's place there for you to record the different funds. And this is important because, for example, we need to know what specifically are you asking the personnel development to committee to approve. What is the amount, right? Because you may be, you know, there may be an overall funding request which is quite large for the conference and everything as a whole. We need to know what our specific part is. Okay, and then once that part is included, it simply requires getting the approvals at the end. You have to sign the form, you get your supervisor to sign the form, and your department head if that person is not your supervisor. Okay? And then the form is submitted to the dean's office. So any questions about the form at this point? Yep?
I have a couple questions, and you can just tell me to shut up if it's too specific for
the venue. No, that's fine. Right.
And so let's imagine that I've gone to a conference in a very nifty place and I'm staying on my vacation days afterwards.
Right.
What departure date do I put? Because on my plane ticket it shows I return a week later.
Conference.
Okay, so the question is how specific do we have to be about the dates, the departure dates, the return dates? This at the top, you'll notice this is also a leave request form. So you would probably have to include the dates. My first guess to respond to that would be you would include the dates that cover the leave, whatever that is. So however specific that is, does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what it is.
My second question is about if no funds are requested, does that fund go to your committee?
No, if no funds because this comes into the, it's submitted to the dean's office, the dean's area, and it will only come to us if there is actually something that our committee needs to look at. Okay. Any questions about the form? No, okay, so just quickly then, sorry. So the process, complete the form, attach supporting information, right? Remember, the more information we have, the better. You don't have to go overboard, but it's just whatever we have to help us make a decision and to understand what's there would be greatly appreciated. It will make things go a lot faster. Get approval from your supervisor and your department head. Submit the form to the dean's office. The request will be reviewed. The committee meets every week. We meet every Tuesday, and we review them on a weekly basis. So by the, when, once they get to the dean's office, you can know that the next Tuesday they will be reviewed, and if we have all the information, we have everything we need to know, we can get that processed right away. Okay. If there are any questions, you can submit those about this form in general. The best thing to do would be to submit them to Bruna, because this form is used in a variety of purposes. You may have questions which are outside the scope of our specific committee. So the best thing to do would be to submit the questions to Bruna, and she will be able to direct them to the right person if she doesn't already know the answer herself, which she probably will. Okay. So any other questions? Yep.
How would we know that it's been approved? What would be the, you receive the form back, or is there a letter?
You receive the form back with, you know, okay, so the question is, how do we know what the result is, whether it's been approved? How do we get word of that? And the answer is?
Cabinet people, and it's on the form, and it's the responsibility of the associate director.
Right.
Or in your case, we'll have to.
Right. Okay. I understand. So you will hear back from your associate director.
That's
the
right.
Process. The form will come back, and your associate director will let you know that it's been approved. Okay.
No paper copies sent anymore. It's all online.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? Nope. Okay. Super. So I'll go forward to the next topic. You don't need to applaud. The next topic, very quickly, about, now you may not want to applaud. You may not want to. Okay, so someone note there were applause to do with the website. I know they weren't, but I'll take them. Okay, so essentially this is just a very quick 5-minute update just to let you know that after looking at the system, the new web management system that's being rolled out at McGill, we have decided to undertake our migration to this in a two-phased approach, and we will. The first phase of that is underway now, and in this phase we'll be focusing on making the improvements that we need for the upcoming year. The actual migration to Drupal will only take place, the migration to the web management system, the new system, will only take place in December. If the system is not ready, it does not meet all of our needs at this point. The web team is, the central CCS web team is working frantically to make the improvements that are necessary. Those will be in place sometime this summer, and we just figured it was better overall, given the amount of work we have to do, to take this in a two-step approach. So we'll be making a number of improvements, and I'll be talking about these. I'll be posting information on the staff blog. There'll be opportunities for you to see some of the scope of the work and what we'll be working on to provide feedback. All of that will be happening over the course of the next few months. Major areas, I know we will be making some changes to the homepage. We'll be making changes to the way the branch pages are handled, some long overdue improvements there. The new changes will be finished by August 1st. Okay, so I learned my lesson last year. Don't change the website in August. Change it before. So we'll do all this work, and August 1st we'll have the changes in place, so that you can prepare your materials for the fall. We will then begin work on phase two, which will be in moving the website over to a new publishing system. So basically changing the underlying engine, which is used to manage the content and publish the site. We will adopt a new visual template. You've seen some of the other McGill sites, like Human Resources, et cetera, which have this new look and feel, the new McGill template. So we'll be adopting that at that time. We'll be making minimal changes to content and applications. In fact, the only changes that we'll be making are those necessary because of the migration to a new publishing system. But we won't be implementing new features or anything like that in December. It's strictly to migrate and change the underlying system that we use to run the website. And, of course, leading up to that time, there will have to be staff training on how to use the new system and use the new publishing tools for those of you who have responsibilities for editing content on the website. Okay. So, any questions about that now. Yep.
For the first part, where you'll be making changes to home page and branch pages, et cetera, would you say that when do people get a chance to see what the changes are?
So
on August 1st, or will there be a...
Okay, so the question is, for the changes that are happening for the phase one August 1st deadline, when will people get a chance to see some of those changes? I don't have the exact timeline in front of me. You will get a chance to see and comment on the changes before August 1st. August 1st will not be a surprise to anyone, or it shouldn't be a surprise. The goal is not, I'm not here to surprise you on August 1st, because that probably won't go well. So you'll have a chance beforehand to see the changes that are being proposed as mock-ups to provide feedback and to make sure that everything is in line. So that'll happen over the course of the summer. And that information will all be on the staff blog. There may be other meetings that are held, but at the very least, all the information will be available on the staff blog. And if at any time you have any questions or concerns about anything to do with the process, you can contact me directly. I'd be glad to sit down and talk to you, answer your questions, whatever you need. Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We are about to get to human resources update and announcements. I just want to make sure that people understood about the website migration, that phase one is content, phase two is look and feel, and a whole lot of the programming work that underlies the system. So that's the summary, at least from my understanding. And he'd tell me if I were wrong. So, Diane?
Great. Thank you. You may have the best job, but I have the best section in the Dean's Corner because it deals with staff announcements and updates. And we're going to introduce a new feature this Dean's Corner when I refer to one of our staff accomplishments, our new hires. They're going to stand up. So we have a wall of fame here on the left-hand side. So you'll be directing your attention to them shortly. First, we have several new hires, which I'd like to introduce you to. First of all, Passant El-Alfi has joined us in the Humanities and Social Sciences Library as a documentation technician. So she's joining the Hustle team. Passant joined us on Monday, May 16th, so you're in day four. Situated beside Passant is our other new hire for the Humanities and Social Sciences Library, Blair Trolinski, also a documentation technician and also started on Monday. So welcome. Good. We are delighted to have Isabelle Roberge join us as our senior human resources advisor. I'll have her stand up. You're going to get to know Isabelle very well. Isabelle also joined us on Monday, May 16th, and transferred over from the CIO's office. She's been at McGill for 13 years. And we're delighted that she's able to join us as a senior HR advisor. Also on May 16th, we welcomed Ron Tuckey, who is a programmer analyst joining the library LTS team, Library Technical Services. And Ron also has been at McGill for a little over a year.
Almost a year.
Came from ISR, so experience, knows his way around Banner and other areas, so we're delighted to have Ron in the LTS team. Welcome. Now, at the last Dean's Corner, I had a list of retirees, and for some reason, I didn't have Pamela Miller's name on as a retiree. So, to make sure it's on record, I wanted to ensure that we recognize Pam's retirement as of May 31st. Now, a couple of congratulations for accomplishments, and if I've left anybody out, do let me know, and we'll get you on the next Dean's Corner. But first of all, I'm going backwards. Let me go in the right direction. Daniel Boyer was acclaimed as the librarian representative on Senate. We had a nomination procedure was followed, and Danielle Boyer was nominated and acclaimed as the new senator. So congratulations, Danielle, who is traveling right now. The most recent issue of the journal New Library World includes an article from our very own Robin Canwell, who is sitting right there, for those of you that don't know Robin. So congratulations. This is exciting. Megan Fitzgibbons was named the Canadian Association of College and University Libraries New Academic Librarian of the Year for 2011. Congratulations. And Joseph Hafner, who's not in the Wall of Fame, but I don't know if we can get a picture of you. Can you swing back for Joseph there? Joseph was reelected to the OCLC America's Regional Council. Great. And the congratulations continue. Back to the wall. Svetlana Kochinka was awarded the new member bursary to attend and present at the annual conference of the American Association of Law Librarians. Congratulations. I don't think Chris Lyons is here. Chris, are you here? No. Elected vice president, president-elect of Archivists and Librarians in the History of the Health Sciences. So we want to extend our deepest congratulations to Chris. And continuing on in that vein, Pam Miller was elected second vice president of the American Osler Society. So she's going to continue to be busy post-retirement. Congratulations, Pam. And back to the wall, we have Joel Natenvloot was acclaimed to the M4 Management Steering Committee. So we look forward to your contributions to that, Joel. Thank you. Great. Good. A couple of other announcements to put into your diaries. Make sure that you join your colleagues at the staff barbecue, where we'll be making announcements of the staff excellence awards. It's going to be great fun should it ever warm up. It's going to be Wednesday, May 25th. That's next week, I believe. And it's from noon to 2. It's at the Three Bears Park. For those of you new to McGill, it's just the park just to the right of this Redpath Museum. And do RSVP so we can cater properly, and all are welcome. Please come. Reminding you that convocation is Friday, May 27th to Friday, June 3rd, so from a week starting next Friday. So we all want to put our best foot forward in all of our branches, make sure that all the visitors, parents, friends, graduates, are welcomed in our branches, and that we're all very welcoming. Finally, you may have seen this on the website. The university is putting together the McGill 190th celebration plan. So 2011 actually is the 190th anniversary of McGill. There are a lot of interesting things being pulled together to help promote McGill, to highlight McGill, and celebratory activities will start, they're actually starting now. You've probably noticed the banners around the city marking the 190th. It's really going to kick off at homecoming in the fall, and will run straight through till the spring. So the library is going to get involved with incorporating a 190th theme. We're working on some plans. We'd love to get some ideas from any of you or all of you on how we can showcase the library and participate in the celebrations. So Marika Raimundo, where's Marika? Everyone knows Marika, right? she can stand up. Yes, good. Do contact her, and we will keep you informed of what we're doing. And that's it for, you're going to speak. Okay.
Don't hit the button.
I will back up.
No,
there.
That's okay.
Good. Good. Thanks.
Thank you,
Diane.
Congratulations,
Dolly.
Any questions for Diane? Near or far? Thank you. I have a still got about 20 minutes, and I've got several things I need to go over really quickly. First, ARL, which I spoke about before. The ARL meeting was here week before last in Montreal. It was a resounding success. People loved Montreal, and they really loved to hear Heather Monroe speak. She was incredibly well-received, and I got many compliments on her as if I had anything to do with her. Anyway, but it was great to bask in her shadow. In any case, it was a resounding success, and thank you all. I know that some of my colleagues did show up in your libraries, and you were wonderful hosts and hostesses, and I appreciate that. We are doing fundraising events. I was recently in New York with Stephen, and we did a small friends raising and recognition event. Some wonderful friends of ours, McGill friends, hosted us in their home. There were about 30 people there, all McGill alums, all people with some who have had wonderful lives, to some great extent, which we're trying to remind them as a result of McGill and its libraries in particular. So Adam Gopnik was there of New Yorker fame, and the theme of the evening was food. So we took some of our rare book cookbooks. It was quite a success. It was a great deal of fun. And these events, this sort of stewardship, can sometimes take 10 or a lifetime of years to result in people giving back to the libraries sometime during their lives. So it's good stewardship that we're involved in, and of course what we're really hoping to do is to, these are philanthropic exercises, and eventually we hope that people give back to McGill in kind. I particularly want to welcome Isabel, our new HR person. This position is key and fundamental to all of you. Please feel free to contact her with anything and everything that you may need to be involved with in the HR area. You've already heard about the staff appreciation event. Of course, the barbecue is on May 25th. Please RSVP. Note if you're vegetarian. Let us know you're a vegetarian, you're going to be identified in some way, that is, however, but we don't want people taking your food. So we're going to make sure that we do that properly. This is an event where we in the dean's office and those who are heads of branches are going to be serving you and thanking you for the work that you have done on behalf of users all year. So we're going to be behind the line in aprons and making sure that you're served before we eat. This is the way it should be. Sorry? I am going to wear my cowboy boots. If it's not raining, in which case, I'm not going to wear my cowboy boots. I'm going to wear these little yellow ducky things I've got. But in any case, please do come. It's a small way to say thank you on behalf of all of us to you. It is a staff recognition event, so we will be announcing the two staff awards, a librarian's award and a staff award at that event, and honoring the people who were also nominated. So that's a very nice thing. So please do come. Congratulations again. I want to thank Joanna Baer for her good work as our senator stepping down. And I want to thank everybody again for your patience and goodwill for all the renovations going on through all of the libraries. Couple of things that I thought that you would want to know about. We are definitely engaged in budget preparation and planning.
I'll walk you through the budget at a point that I feel that it's even close to real, but it's going to take a long time this year. To really put together a budget the way you need to, you have to have gone through a whole year's cycle. Anybody who's worked in acquisitions understands this really well. I started my life as a librarian practically almost immediately. My first job was a serials cataloger. My second job was an acquisitions librarian. I live and breathe collections budgets and budgets as a whole. So this is something we will be showing you in some detail, but it's a work in progress right now and isn't ready for prime time. I think that the people who are involved in it most are nodding their heads in agreement. It's really true. But we're all working very, very hard on it. We're meeting at least once a week trying to go through it all. In terms of searches for librarians, I'm announcing a search committee, a search advisory committee today. It met for the first time today. One thing that I need to do in prep for telling you about this is that, honestly, given libraries and the way and our times and information, the internet, everything that's going on in libraries, the only thing that I can guarantee any of you is change. Your jobs are going to change. All of our jobs are going to change. What we do is going to change. How we do it's going to change. Many of you have worked in libraries for a long time. I got my degree in 1975, and I felt like I stepped on a treadmill, and it's just gotten faster and faster. No one's going to lose their jobs, as long as, assuming you perform, you know. No one's going to lose their jobs, but what you do in your jobs and how jobs are constituted and what jobs exist are all fundamentally a reflection of what we need to do at this time and place to serve our users. Of course, we will be doing this in concert with rules and regulations and understandings and collective bargaining agreements. We honor all of that. We appreciate it. We'll be communicating with you as much as possible. But all of this is preparatory to say that every opening that comes open is an opportunity for us to sit back and reflect on what we need for the future. So every time a job comes open, we're going to be looking at what's the best way to use those dollars. And so right now, because we had sort of a bunch of jobs that have come open, I'm putting together a search advisory committee. I can tell you that this particular committee is constituted the way it is because there are certain fundamentals of searches that I believe are important. One is that the people who are most directly involved need to be part of the search. So you'll see that the positions I announced, there's a representative from each one of those libraries on the committee. Secondly, I believe that search committees, keep in mind this is advisory, search committees need to be representative of the organization as a whole because each one of us are part of not only the music library or the law library, we're part of the library community at McGill, and we have a lot of good thoughts that we can offer to our profession as a whole. So you'll see that's behind this too. There are certain people who are on the committee by virtue of their positions ex officio. Diane will chair the committee. It's her under her jurisdiction that planning and administration and HR comes. Isabelle Roberge will be there because I can already tell you she knows a lot of stuff that's really important to these questions. And I will be ex officio, but I will be there to answer questions, but it's the search committee and its processes are advisory to me. The members of the committee are, and this is one committee, this is not how necessarily search committees will be constituted all the time. It's just that we have this backlog, and given the positions that are open, putting in representatives from each one of these groups together just makes a very representative committee in terms of libraries, in terms of years of service, and all sorts of things. So it's Daniel Boyer, Susan Murray, Sarah Holder, Louis Uhl, Amy Buckland, and a very special person whom I feel is very important to be on a search committee, and that's a staff representative, and that will be Peter Martinek. Librarians work very closely with staff. Staff work very closely with librarians, and I think it's essential that a staff representative be on search advisory committees. The positions that we are going forward and announcing and that we will be searching for right now are a tenure track law librarian, a liaison tenure track person in life sciences, a liaison librarian tenure track in Schulich science and engineering, an assessment librarian who will be reporting to me, the associate director for digital initiatives, Louise O'Neill's position we're going forward on. So if you look at the people who are on the committee, you'll see that there's sort of a one-to-one correspondence with these positions and the people on the committee. But by doing that, I've got this terrific representation of the library as a whole. We will also be going forward and posting, doing an internal posting for head of education while Sarah Holder is on sabbatical. So those are the positions that we're currently searching for. I've heard Heather Monroe Bloom speak on several occasions of how proud she is of the fine staff and faculty and academic staff at this institution, so we will be casting very wide nets for our positions. We will do international searches and we'll make sure that we find the best person. We will be inviting two, maybe three people to do interviews. Everybody will be involved in different parts of the interview. Each candidate will be asked to do a presentation. Presentation will be open to anybody and everybody to attend, and we'll solicit feedback on how you felt this person was. Do you feel that this is someone whom you would want to work with? Do you feel that their qualifications meet the job description? The rest of the interviews will be tailor-made more around the individual position. So, for instance, if it's the position in life sciences, a day-long interview will be constructed so that individuals mainly from life sciences will have time to get to know the individual, give us their input. In an immediate sense, they're the people whom we need to get immediate feedback from, but it's not exclusive because all of our positions and our librarians are members of the library community as a whole. Let's see. What did I forget? Did I forget anything with this? We're hoping the positions will be posted as quickly as possible, and will be posted for at least 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and at every place that we can possibly put them up. I mean, as I said, we're going to cast the net as widely as we possibly can, and we will start combing through applications as soon as we can. They will be evaluated on a grid is common practice for librarians, but it's also common practice here for M's. So a grid is constructed from the qualifications and the position announcement and the position description, and then paper qualifications are evaluated against that grid. You've got a lot of inter-rater reliability going on because you have great representation from many constituencies on the committee. A number of people you come up with a short list, you weed that down, call references, do phone interviews before bringing people on campus if that's what we decide to do, and then eventually 2 to 3 people are invited to campus. We will keep the jobs open until we find a candidate. We won't be We will not be posting anything, assuming it's legal, and I think it is. I'm looking at Isabel. We won't be posting closing dates on our job ads because we will continue to search and accept applications until we actually close on a search and make an offer.
Just the exception is the interim head.
Yes. Yes, and I was reminded that the exception, of course, is for the head of education, which is posted internally originally and won't be, we won't go out for an external search with that. Unless we absolutely need to, I guess. Yes, questions?
I think I heard you say that there are representatives from the different constituencies on the committee. Was there a representative from Schulich on that committee?
Louis. The question. The question was there a representative from Schulich on the committee, and Louis is represented. Any other questions about anything? Yes.
Do you have an estimated time frame for the first meeting of the new Library Council, which Provost Massey approved a couple of weeks ago?
Very soon. Yeah, it's something that I'm going to be discussing with people in the provost's office and the principal very quickly. I've already got some major agenda items for that. I'm really looking forward to having that venue. It's something that I've missed here. I'm used to being able to speak with librarians as a group in an organized fashion, and I haven't had that here. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I wondered, I know it's all different, different approach, but I just wondered, is there currently a review of replacing and advertising those positions taking place?
The question is, having just talked quite at length about our search advisory committee to the dean, by the way, they will come up with a short list and will be making recommendations to me as an advisory committee, and they will be noting candidates as acceptable and not acceptable, and the decision is mine. The final decision is mine as dean. In any case, the question was, what's the parallel track, essentially, going on for staff? And it is ongoing. I point out that we have introduced recently four new hires who are staff positions. And there has not been quite the critical mass, shall we say, of openings in staff positions that have warranted this kind of approach right now. But we do evaluate every opening. We are evaluating every staff opening on a case-by-case basis. And if there are particular ones that anyone is concerned about, you need to get those cards and letters into your supervisors, who then make sure that we hear about it in the dean's office. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, any questions from afar? Okay. Yeah, there was one question I had that was posed, someone wanted me to address, that came before the meeting, and it was... Someone had noted that at Texas A&M, where I came from, there had been some interaction with McKinsey, the same consulting firm that has been a consultant for McGill for the strategic planning.
Reframing.
I knew it was an R. Thank you. Strategic reframing. That always reminds me of... Never mind. It's an acronym that I remember from the fourth grade. But in any case, the consultants for the Strategic Reframing Initiative, and, you know, I wish I could tell you that I had some experience with it. As far as I know, it was not a major thing at Texas A&M. It was not a major part of our restructuring of anything in our strategic plan or long-range planning at Texas A&M. So I really don't have any words of wisdom to offer in terms of a parallel advice. I do know that at one point at Texas A&M, they were brought in to do probably something called Vision 2020, which was our very much long-range planning initiative that we were involved at Texas A&M in 10 years ago. That was a mammoth undertaking that actually was hugely successful. That's the main thing that McKinsey was involved in. And so I don't have a lot to offer there. If I can remember anything else in the deepest, darkest recesses of my brain, I will try to remember and bring it to this forum if that's of interest to anybody. Assuming there are no other questions, I just want to remind people that what goes on in these meetings, I thank you all for being here. I really thank the people who are coming in remotely. These meetings are essential to how to the many, many ways that I'm trying in with knowledge of forethought in a very deliberate way, trying to communicate with the entire library community. So if there's someone not here, don't forget to remind them that they're responsible for what happened here, and they need to watch. They need to talk to one of you, or they need to watch the streaming so that this information really does get out to everybody. If you find that there's something here that's boring you to tears, then let us know too, because we might want to make sure that these enterprises, which are very expensive in terms of human capital, are truly relevant to the needs of the organization. So thank you all very much.